love and respect for each other, unity, clear thinking, and well-being. We will also explore our historical movements and memories through music. By weaving music and histories together, we will enrich our understanding and appreciation of both. I'm Jordan Cato Strudwick, host of the new program Blue Notes, and I'm looking forward to spending Wednesday nights with you from 10 p.m. to midnight on WPFW 89.3 FM Washington, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo. Young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day or Oscar Robertson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome to the collision. He's Aton Thomas. I'm Dave Zirin here at your home for Jazz and Justice, 89.3 FM WPFW. Chuck Modiano is on a plane today. Aton, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Let me tell the crowd out there listening that at 10:20, not 10:30, 10:20 a.m. in just 20 minutes, we got Michael Lee from the Washington Post who's going to come with us on this journey that we call the collision. He wrote an article, Aton, called, which I found utterly fascinating, Where Tackle Football Still Reigns. And then the subhead is, in Mississippi, football, that's the tackle version, is still viewed by many young people as a source of pride and a way out, despite the game's risks. Fascinating article, Aton, that looks at the question of why, when tackle football participation is down across the country, is it actually on a high rise up in Mississippi and in Alabama? Pretty interesting, huh?
No, I thought it was a really interesting article. And I want to hear him expound on a lot of the points that he made. A lot of people, it's interesting because, you know, I know a lot of guys in the NFL and a lot of them kind of don't want their children, you know, to play football. Mm-hmm. I always found that interesting. But then you see in different places, like you said, and especially in the South, like Mississippi, Florida, you know, Alabama, it's really on the rise. So it's definitely an interesting topic.
It is interesting. And of course, we got to talk a little hoops with Michael Lee, former national basketball writer at The Athletic, because this season has been mighty juicy of topics.
I mean, it's a whole lot. You know, I was actually at the Wizards of Detroit game on MLK Day. I did a event there, you know, and then shout out to the Wizards for doing this, you know, Martin Luther King spoken word event. It was really great. But, whew, they lost to Detroit. I mean, things look pretty down right now for the Wizards. I would definitely like to hear his take and your take on that about where do the Wizards go from here?
Mm. Where they go? Hopefully not Virginia.
Oh my gosh, that's a whole other topic.
we'll talk to Michael Lee about all that stuff. But you know, speaking of hoops, Etan, I just came across this and I was like, okay, I haven't even given Etan a heads up that I want to ask him about this, but if anybody would have something to say about this, it would be you. I gotta ask you this.
Go for it.
I just saw that the DC metro area has not 1, 2, 3, or 4, but 5 teams in the ESPN National Top 25 Boys High School Hoop Squad. 5 out of 25 is in our little scrape of land right here. Mm-hmm. So big shout out to Jackson Reed High School, formerly known as Wilson, Gonzaga, PVI, Bullis, and O'Connell. Mm-hmm. 5 schools. No other region in the country has more than 2. So just as Michael Lee is writing about how Mississippi and Alabama produce more NFL players than anywhere in the country, we are like that with hoops. Why do you think our part of the country is so rich when it comes to these schools, these players, and this culture?
Well, you know, KD did a great documentary called Something in the Water a few years ago, and it really explored this in depth of why, you know, this is such a rich area, you know, talking about the DMV as a whole. I mean, that's not even including Baltimore, you know, right. It's like you don't really include Baltimore with the DMV, but it's like right down the street. You know what I mean? I mean, they play against each other all the time. It's, you know, it's really right down the street. But yeah, it's just a rich area in that. And it always has been in the competition level, especially at the AAU level coming up. There's just so much talent. Mm-hmm. And it's been a hotbed for a while. But yeah, no, this is just a special place. But I would really encourage people to go watch that documentary, In the Water. And that one is more focused on PG County. But it really, you know, expands to the whole DMV.
No, I hear you. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where success begets success. It's like, why are there so many track stars out of Jamaica? You know what I'm saying? Of everywhere in the region. Why Jamaica? I mean, one reason is that, you know, they have some stars a few decades back, and then they come back to Jamaica, they invest, they coach, you know, they're looked at as heroes. Next thing you know, Jamaica's the spot.
Right.
And so I look at that like here too, you know, steel sharpens steel. Mm-hmm. People see people like, let's go back, you know, Adrian Dantley, John Thompson. You know, and it creates its own culture that then reproduces itself. That's the only thing I can think of.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And it's not saying that you don't have that in other places. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, you know, you have New York, you have Chicago, you have L.A., you have other places. But here in the DMV, you know, especially PG County, I mean, there's just the talent level, you know, is just so high. And it's been like that for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was surprised not to see DeMatha there in that 25.
We started off at the top, and then we dropped a few in some of the we went to a tournament, and it's the crazy part, you know, playing in these national tournaments where you're playing against top teams. Sometimes you drop a game or two, you know. Mm-hmm. Actually beat O'Connell about a week ago.
Wow.
In the top 25. Yeah, beat them pretty handedly too. But the WCAC, That conference is also one of the top conferences in the country. So you're going to have games where, like, you remember, you know, I don't know about now, but you know, back in the day when the Big East was like, you know, whenever teams played against each other, certain rivalries, no matter where the teams were ranked, it was always a fantastic game. You know what I mean? Whether it's Georgetown, Syracuse, whether it's, you know, you throw in St. John's or whatever it was. Right. It was always like a fantastic game. That's how the WCAC is. And, you know, if anybody has even seen the games that have been there so far, I mean, they've just been really, really, like, fantastic displays of basketball. This is just a special place.
It is a special place. I have no proof of this, but I think kids around here also want to be coached. Like, I've done very youth coaching, not nearly what you've done, but, like, the kids, I've never had a kid who was like, I don't want to listen to you.
Mm.
Like, I get, you've maybe had that.
Yeah, you're going to have that. It's not, I wouldn't make a sweeping statement and say there is definitely a negative aspect of AAU culture as a whole. And there are different pockets where, you know, especially as, you know, being around the circuits and things of that nature, you see a lot of stuff. And that's the one where, like, if we talked about this with Coach McNutt, I mean, he would go off for probably about, you know, 30 minutes straight talking about what he's seen, you know? I mean, yeah. So you definitely do have that aspect, but you do also have a lot of the positive aspect where you have a standard and you have things that aren't tolerated and you have, you know, you have both. I'll say you have both.
Mm-hmm. And shout out to Coach McNutt, who is coaching this season. He is coaching a ninth grade team out in Virginia. That's what we need, is people doing that kind of work across the board, especially people who know what the game is all about.
Definitely. We definitely do. But you know what? I wanted to ask you something, too.
Please.
So I was watching the 76ers and Nuggets game. Great game. Anybody that didn't see it, it was a great game. But of course, the game that we've been wanting to see for so long, and the battle with against Jokic and Joel Embiid. Did you happen to see that game?
I certainly did, every second of it.
It was a great game, and you know, Embiid had a really dominant type of performance, and 76ers won. And after the game, he definitely gave Jokic his props, said he was the best player in the NBA. You know what I mean? It was sometimes the media does a job of trying to pit players against each other. And I think that's kind of what that was. It showed that, no, we don't have to be sworn enemies to be competitors. What do you think about that? There's a lot to talk about with this. But, you know, I know back in the day, you know, we both grew up Knicks fans, and, you know, Knicks fans, you know, there was this thing where you know, they didn't like certain teams, and there's no love loss. And, you know, after the game, you have to be separated and all that. But it doesn't have to be that way. Where are you on that topic? Because a lot of people have different, you know, opinions on that. They say, okay, all these players nowadays, they're all friends. They're all cool with each other. They're liking each other's posts on Instagram and all that different stuff. You know, and they have a problem with it, as if they can't compete at the highest level once they step on the court.
Well, first of all, let's think about it way back in the day. Like, mm-hmm. Oscar Robertson goes to Cincinnati, and then by NBA rules, he plays for the Cincinnati pro team. I forget what they were called. But, like, right. If you went to the college, you know, your regional pro team had dibs on even signing you. So that created kind of like a regional hardness, that when you're going against somebody else, you're representing not just your team, but your region. Fast forward to today, like you mentioned it, the AAU circuit, you know, everybody, you know, transfer portal, everybody knows each other. There's definitely never been more familiarity between the players. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. Although Joel Embiid, you know, Nikola Jokic, you know, from two different parts of the world, it's not like they were in playing AAU together, for goodness sakes. I mean, both those guys, I think what binds them, and maybe what makes Joel Embiid respect Jokic and Jokic respect Embiid, mm-hmm. is the fact that both of them, you know, as late as their late teens, were big time projects. Like most top players, when they're 19, you're like, oh, they've got the goods. These guys were figuring it out because they started, you know, especially Embiid started late, and Jokic was somebody who was disregarded because of his body type.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, let's never forget that when Jokic was drafted, there was a Taco Bell commercial going on in the second round. It wasn't even on TV.
Right.
They had to say, hey, in the commercial break, this dude we've never heard of got drafted in the second round. You know what I'm saying?
Uh-huh.
So not exactly coming in with fireworks like old Patrick Ewing or anything.
Right.
But the other thing is, and I don't know if this relates, but my number one impression of the game itself that we're discussing is when it got time to winning time, and I'm curious your thoughts about this.
Mm-hmm.
When it got time to winning time, who was Joel Embiid guarding? He was guarding Nikola Jokic.
Mm-hmm.
It was Nikola Jokic guarding, not Joel Embiid.
Right.
And I think back in the day, you know, Patrick Ewing's sweat and Moses Malone's sweat were one. They were battling. You know, I always think of Moses with Patrick, because Patrick's first game ever was against Moses. But right. Fast forward to Akeem, fast forward to Shaquille, fast forward to David Robinson. These guys guarded each other, and it right. could get nasty and always physical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a different vibe now with all the switching on defense, with players not necessarily being in the paint. I mean, Joel Embiid's jump shot, it was just butter.
Yeah.
And Nikola's getting it on the high post. I mean, it's a little bit different just in terms of the kind of physical animus that can take place during a game. That's my read on it. But to get directly to your question, it's like, nah, respect to me is always better than hate. You know what I'm saying? Because
mm-hmm.
I always have one ear to the fact that, you know, as somebody who coaches kids, that I know that my players are watching, learning, developing their own feelings about how they want to be. And so there's something about that where I'm like, good, play hard, shake hands. That's what I want for my team. That's what I want for the example of them to be. That's my take. But please, you as the person who played a decade in the L has more to say about it than I do.
No, I think you did a great job of breaking it all down. You know, but it was the matchup that we've been wanting to see for a long time. And, you know, but my second thought was that it was about the media. And I mentioned a little bit about how they really are trying to pit them against each other. And I saw it during the MVP race, you know, the past few years. And they both really had nothing but complimentary things to say about each other, you know, too much to the point where, Jokic one time was like, okay, I don't even want to talk about this anymore. You know what I mean? Like, ask me about something. I don't want to talk about this anymore because I see what you guys are doing. And I kind of see that same aspect happening. I'm drawing a comparison with Angel Reese and Caitlin Clark. It's like trying to pit them against each other and market it as a way where you are trying to have one group root for one side and one group root for another side. But it's a different feeling of it. No, okay, so for instance, obviously with Magic and Bird, that was a definite dynamic that was exploited. You know, some people you talk to, they say you kind of are playing to and marketing racial tensions or racial identity in sports, and it works, and it worked with Magic and Bird. And that's, you know, you can't really argue with that. But I just kind of see that again happening when I'm listening to different commentators and the way they're talking, you know, different articles and, you know, with Andrew Reese and Clayton Clark, and I'm making a correlation with, you know, Embiid. I just see them kind of pushing this. And I'm glad that all the players that I've mentioned have kind of not played into that and been complimentary of the other player. You know what I mean? And mm-hmm. and not falling into that, because I don't know. I don't know. When I see it happening, I'm like, I see what they're trying to do, you know, but they're not taking the bait. So good.
I mean, I wrote about that with Caitlin Clark when they tried to pit her against Angel Reese. I just don't think that generation is having it. Like, let me put it this way. If you are self-aware and you are under 25 and you are white, you are either not going to play into that or you are consciously going to play into that. And right. Which, of course, is horrible. But like mm-hmm. back in the days with Magic and Bird, it was almost like they were on a wave that they couldn't even necessarily control because mm-hmm. the media was so intent on pitting them against each other.
Right.
That before you knew it, you know, Magic had a deep dislike for Bird, and Bird had a deep dislike for everybody. But right. fascinating, though, that as soon as like 1985, I believe, no, I'm correct about this. I'm not sure if it was 85, but it was the mid-80s. Magic wrote the intro to Larry Bird's memoir, Drive.
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, and it was already talking that respect. They were doing commercials together. Remember where they played one-on-one in the,
right.
on the driveway?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Magic, let's see what you got, you know?
Right.
I love that commercial. So it's like, the media was pushing these two like-minded souls apart. And it was almost like it took years for them to sort of figure it out and come together as respectful, great players of their era. You go to Caitlin Clark, you know, she didn't need years, and Angel Reese as well, did not need years to figure out what the story was and what was being done. Mm-hmm. And they backed off of it to their great credit because, I mean, these days it gets mighty ugly, mighty fast. So if you don't stand up to it mighty quick,
right,
all of a sudden, you know, you're part of the problem.
But it's like they're setting them up. So like the setup, Jokic say, yeah, they wanted him to say, yeah, I think it was unfair. And then there was a certain, you know, component that might have been why he was the MVP and not me. Or with Caitlin, when they were like, okay, don't you think that you should share the, he was like, she was like, said, no, I should share. We lost. You know, but I'm glad that they took those stances that they took because it was the setup. You know what I mean? And like you said, you know, young players, in your case, you know, he's not even from here, but I'm glad that he didn't take that bait. Because I think as soon as they would have taken that bait, they would have ran with it.
I mean, Embiid seems extremely self-aware, and Jokic seems just, I'm being frank here, just incredibly nice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little hard to take self-aware and nice and turn it into Magic and Bird 1979. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but those media setup questions, they can set it up where all they need is a little sound bite. All they need is a little quote to be able to run with it. And they have been careful with their words. So where yeah. they didn't allow them to even take something out of context.
Well, it's the equivalent if I said to you, Etan, instead of saying, do you respect the Georgetown basketball program? Instead of asking that, if I asked, how much do you respect the program? Do you expect the program not at all or less than not at all?
Right. Right.
Make your choice.
Yeah. From just from those two options.
Yeah. But I digress. Thrilled to have him on the line right now. We promised you 10-20. Can't wait to speak to him about this incredible article he wrote, Where Tackle Football Still Reigns, about Mississippi and to a lesser extent Alabama, places in the country where football, the tackle version, is actually on the rise, bucking the trends of the rest of the country. Brilliant article. Thrilled to have him on the line from the Post, Michael Lee. Michael, how you doing, sir?
Yeah, let's take a quick break like we always do.
Can we take a break right now? Let's take a quick break. We'll get Michael on the line, and then all will be delicious. We'll be back right after this on The Collision.
Bucka, 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 bucka. Ha-ha. You know the deal. This is me, though. Beats by Supremo for all of my people, Negroes and Latinos, and even the gringos. Yo, check it, one for Charlie Hustle, two for Steady Rock, three for the fourth coming live, future shot. It's five dimensions, six senses, seven firmaments of heaven to hell, 8 million stories to tell, nine planets faithfully keep an orbit with the probable tenth. The universe expands length, the body of my text possess extra strength, power lifted powerless, up out of this towering inferno, my aim so hot it burned through the journal. I'm blacker than midnight on Broadway at Myrtle. Hip hop past all your tall social hurdles, like the nationwide projects, prison industry complex, working class poor, better keep your alarm set. Streets too loud to ever hear freedom ring. Say it back in with your sleep. It's dangerous to dream, but your chain cats get the chip. You dead now. Killing fields need blood to graze the cash cow. It's a numbers game, but you don't add up somehow.
We are back here on The Collision. That was our bottom of the hour breaks. Now we can roll straight through. Tom, before we go to Michael Lee, can you tell us who that was? And I think you have a certain Joker card up your sleeve. Please talk to us.
Hey, that was Mos Def yesterday. Mm. I have been a fan, you know, since I first heard him. And yes, there is a reason why I played it. He was in the news a little while ago talking about Drake. The person asked him about Drake. Not like he just started talking about Drake. And it was his preference. He said, you know, made a reference that Drake is like pop music. And, you know, like if I heard, what do you say, if I was listening to music while I was shopping at Target. You know, and it, so it became a big thing. I don't know if he was necessarily dissing him, but I know what he was saying because he is pop, and pop is very likable and very popular. So I don't know if it was necessarily a diss, but always much respect to Mos Def.
Absolutely. I personally didn't see it as a diss. I saw it as social commentary. Sharp, incisive, and frankly, way too real for the way the discourse usually is, where someone is either, you know, everything's all good or someone's a sucker. And this was different. This was elevated. This was, yo, this is the reality of the landscape. And he even went on talking about the collapse of empire. Like, he got so deep, but all everybody focused on was the Drake part.
Yeah, that's how the media clickbait, you know, portion of where we are as a society now happens. That's how it is.
Well, speaking of clickbait, I want to talk about the opposite of clickbait, even though I wish it was clickbait, because that would mean the world would read it. A brilliant article by Michael Lee called Where Tackle Football Still Reigns. We told our audience already what it was all about the ways that football is on the rise in Mississippi, Alabama, and how that bucks the trends of the rest of the country. It's such a good article in the Post from December. Everybody should find it. Thrilled to have him on the line, Michael Lee. Michael, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. I enjoyed the conversation about Mos Def. I'm a big fan too, and I feel like it was so over everybody's head that they were just focused on what was below them. They couldn't figure out that he was making a commentary about capitalism, the fall of the empire, the U.S. empire. And they were so focused on Drake that the real thing that he was saying was way over their head. So I just want to throw that in.
No, definitely. 100% agree. 100% agree. And, you know, I'm a big Mos Def fan. So it's so funny when people then were saying that Mos Def, you know, would lose in a battle to Drake and he's not really a lyricist. I was like, oh, hold up now.
Yeah.
I mean, hold on, time out. You can be a Drake fan all you want, but you know what I mean? Come on now.
And you notice that Drake's response was not to come back with a rhyme, but to like do something on social media, which basically supported what Mos was saying.
100%.
But back to the Mississippi article. That was a lot of fun. I mean, it was a great project to be a part of with my colleagues. We did a whole series on just football participation in the United States. And I got a chance to go to Mississippi, which was pretty cool for a lot of reasons. One, like, that's where my grandfather's family's from. So I never spent time in Mississippi. So I got a chance to go there for the first time. But mainly, I got a chance to tell the story about the Starkville High football team, which was in pursuit of going back-to-back state championship. And I got to talk to a bunch of, they got two guys that are going to Division I. The quarterback, Trey Petty, he's going to be at Illinois next year. Their wide receiver committed to Mississippi State. And they got a bunch of kids that basically see football as their only out. And I had to center it on Starkville, but I reported throughout the entire state. I got a whole lot of stuff. But I thought that the Starkville story was deep because Starkville sort of captures what all of Mississippi. They have rural areas in Starkville. They have a sort of urban area because it's a college town where Mississippi State is. And there's all these kids who have this hope of a better life. And I had this coach who actually had a chance to play college football at Jackson State and played in the NFL on a practice squad for a little bit. And his whole goal is to get these guys to college, not to become NFL stars, but to get an education and to wind up having a future that they couldn't have imagined. And he's been coaching. He's 40 years old, but you know, he's really, you know, committed to these kids and making sure that they see beyond their surroundings and beyond what they see. And so it was a really impactful story personally, because like I said, it just started with my family history, but then also spending time with them. You know, I saw there's this place in Starkville called Moon Farm, where it's probably one of the more hopeless places you can imagine. A lot of trailer homes. You know, some people live in sheds, like a lot of squalor, you know, gravel roads. Like it was depressing to be there. And for me, I looked at it as like, man, this is sad, you know. But then I talked to the people there and I came away with a different perspective. Because, you know, it's funny, we talked about this discussion early on with Mos Def and capitalism and then in America we sort of place value in what we have in terms of material possessions, in terms of monetary wealth and things of that nature. But I interviewed a player and I asked him why he played football. And he said, I play because I want to help my mother get, I want to get my mother straight. I want to make sure she's good and I want to give her a better life. And that's why he plays football and that's what motivates him. But when I interviewed his mother and I asked her, because his kid's from Moon Farm, and she was saying that she didn't she wasn't looking to be rescued because she has everything that she wants. Mm. She was the youngest of 10 kids. She's surrounded by her family and her loved ones at all times. Her house is the place where everybody comes to hang out. And so that's what she wants. That's the life that she wants. And she said, if my son ever made it and went somewhere, I will follow him. But I don't, I'm not begging to leave where I am. And then I interviewed one of the coaches who is from that same area. And he laid out something for me in a way that, like, I've never really had a football coach lay it out for me as it relates to, like, life in the world. And he was saying that, you know, this is the same town that produced A.J. Brown from the Philadelphia Eagles. And he played for the school and won a state championship there. And he was telling me how, like, the dedication that A.J. Brown showed to becoming an NFL player and what made him a great player is what went on in his house. Mm-hmm. Even though they lived in a trailer and they were poor, they were still brought taught the principles of hard work, of valuing, you know, yourself and trying to do what you need to do, cleaning your room, you know, all these things that the dedication it takes to be a professional athlete, he was instilled that in his home. And he also said that, you know, you may have the highest house on the highest hill, but you won't find more love in that house than you find in this little itty bitty house here. Mm. And wow. So it made me take a step back and figure out, like, what is valuable to you? What do you value? If you may have money in the bank, but do you have true friends and true families that love you and care for you and support you and make sure that they're there for you through tough times? Like, the money might be good, you might have it, but is it really going to help you through a struggle? Or is it going to have the comfort and love of the support of your family and friends? So while we may look at, you know, people down there and say, oh man, they're poverty stricken, they're lacking, and it is sad that they are lacking in monetary, they still find joy in life. They still find purpose in life. And that's kind of what was my takeaway from that. So I didn't really want to write a story where we judge them and say, oh man, these poor kids, look how miserable their life is. I wanted to kind of people to kind of see that, you know, yeah, they football is what they see as their hope, but football may not lead to an NFL career, but it may lead to a better life and allow them to see the world. But it's not like they're missing on what we should really value, which is having the foundation and support of a community and loved ones who are going to make sure that you kind of succeed. So that's what I came away with, and it changed my perspective on a lot of things. And it's great when you're in this business and you get a chance to do stories like that.
Oh, great stuff. Atan, do you have a question first, or I don't want to?
Oh, no, go ahead. I'll wait till you finish.
Yeah. My question, Michael, though, is, first of all, brilliant story. But second of all, you know, there's poverty in a lot of the United States.
Yeah.
Particularly in the U.S. South. Yet, as you write in the article, Mississippi and Alabama, you know, are really going against the grain in terms of participation.
Yeah.
And obviously, one of the reasons why participation is down across the country is things like head injuries and injuries of that nature. Maybe it's also about infrastructure, funding. But I wanted to ask you, what do you think was different in what you saw that has people looking to football, maybe as opposed to a different sport even, in that part of the country?
Well, the one thing about Mississippi is this. There's fewer than 3 million people there, but there are 33 NFL players from Mississippi.
Wow.
So that small of a state is already overrepresented in the NFL in by ways that, you know, that don't make a lot of sense. And for these kids at Starkville High, they have a relationship with A.J. Brown. Like, he goes back every offseason, hangs out with them. He has their numbers, like one of the star receiver on the team, Braylon Burnside, like that's his god brother, you know, like they're close. And so it's not like it's just that they see the guys on TV and say, oh man, you know, I can make it too. No, they can touch them. They can walk up to them and say, wow, you made it. And then show me how to do it. What do I need to do to get to that level? And so it's not even that they can see it, they can feel it. And I think that provides a level of incentive that other communities may not have, where it's like, yeah, you see the guy on TV, but it's different when he actually is calling you a few days later to give you advice.
So before we was talking about, you know, PG County and the DMV and how rich of a culture they have here, especially with AAU basketball. We're talking about Kevin Durant's In the Water that he made documentary a few years ago. And, yeah, you know, making the, you know, the question always becomes, you know, what makes PG County such a county where there is so, you know, so many young, talented athletes that come out, you know, especially in basketball. And I think you kind of touched on it, you know, when you said, like, well, there's so many people before them and they could reach out and touch them and they see them and they're inspired by them. From what you saw in Mississippi, how does that translate to, you know, and Dave, you know, referenced it a little bit, the difference of, because everywhere else has been kind of a drawback from football in particular. Yeah. As a sport, yeah, you know, as more has, yeah, been, you know, talked about from concussions and safety and, yeah, everything like that. And you have different NFL players saying that, you know, they don't necessarily want their kids to play football. They steer them towards other sports. You know, you have different things coming that. How is that, you know, kind of balanced that, you know, with everything, with that surge that's going on in Mississippi from what you saw?
Well, the one thing that Mississippi, that makes Mississippi unique, is that there aren't any big cities in Mississippi. Jackson, Mississippi is the largest city and it has 100,000 people in it. So you have very small rural communities, like, just spread around the entire state. And, you know, there's no big city, there's no metropolis. You know, the coach I interviewed, he said they didn't get a fast food restaurant until, like, he left to go to college. He got a KFC when he was in college and it was a big deal. And so you have a country culture there. There's no urban center that's going to, you know, just provide any kind of distractions other than, you know, working and football is sort of that outlet. And so, and there's a lot of pride in that community too, in that, you know, they're tough and that they, you know, they break horses, you know, they get kicked, you know, by horses and get knocked out but they still get back on. And so there's a level of, like, pride to say, well, yeah, we can handle anything you throw at us. And so football is sort of a toughness test, you know, because for country kids, you know, who are sort of raised to understand and value hard work. And there, like I said, there's no, like, not if there's like a Dave and Buster's or there's any kind of, like, Chuck E. Cheese is going to, like, say this kid is going to go to that for fun or outlet. Now, for fun, they're going to hit each other, you know, with pads. And so when you go around the country, like, you go around the South, you know, Georgia has Atlanta. Right. That's a big urban epicenter. You know, Alabama has Montgomery and Birmingham, you know, Texas obviously has, you know, Houston and Dallas and San Antonio and stuff like that. So Louisiana has New Orleans. Mississippi doesn't have a big city, you know, so there's nothing to distract you or pull you away from saying I'm going to be a football player. And so a lot of these other states that are able to say, OK, we're going to do other things. Those kids in those communities probably have other distractions, other things they can focus on doing. But, you know, from talking to them, you know, I said, Mississippi, like, football is all we got. You know, I had a chance to go to one of the youth leagues where they had, you know, 5-year-olds to 12-year-olds playing. And, like, that Saturday morning, you know, it was like an event. You know, people were like, it was like homecoming, you know, at a HBCU, like, people out playing music. You know, got plates of, you know, chicken wings and fries. They talking smack to each other. They're dancing. Like, it's like a homecoming, and it's like little kids out there playing, you know, football. So it's ingrained in the culture. And so when you have that and it starts at such a young age, you know, like, it just becomes part of the routine. You know, it's what your life is about. You know, for fun, you play football, you go on trail rides, you know, you go fishing, you go hunting, you do all of these things that are part of country culture, and football is a part of that in Mississippi.
You know, Michael, I know you. You're a city guy. You come from a hoops background. You've lived in cities for your adult life. I gotta ask, to write a story as good as yours, you gotta have people willing to talk to you. And I know you have family from Mississippi, but that's a lot different from coming down there and repping the Washington Post.
Well, yeah, but nobody, none of my family that I know lives down there, so it's not like I had that going for me.
People were willing to talk to you. Was there a bit of a fish out of water element in trying to get the story? How did that work for you?
Everybody was cool. Like, and the coach. I think it started with the coach. Because what they felt like they wanted these kids to get the light shine on them, on them. They wanted a spotlight on Mississippi. They wanted, because they feel like Mississippi is always frowned upon. When you say Mississippi, the immediate, you know, thought is like, you know, Nina Simone, like you want to curse it, you know, right? You know, like you got this negative association with it. And they feel like the fact that these kids are you know, going to college, you know, trying to make something better of themselves is a story that isn't told enough about Mississippi. So they wanted to share whatever they could to make sure that the spotlight was on them. And for them, it was a positive thing that, you know, that these kids can have their name in the paper and that they can understand that there's more than what they have right there in their little community. Because even though, you know, there's small towns and stuff there, they succumb to the same lures, you know, as you find, you know, there's gangs, there's drugs, there's crime, there's things that can get you to go on a bad path. If you want it anywhere you live, you can find it. And so they can find it there too. And so they just kind of wanted to promote the, what they have going on. And they were excited to talk to me for the most part. Like I had so many people that I interviewed for that story. Like, I don't know. It was, you know, dozens upwards of 50 people that I spoke to for that story. Most of them their quotes never saw the light of day. So, but it was great to kind of get that sort of, wisdom and knowledge, and it helped me, you know, steer me in terms of what I was pursuing and who I was talking to and what I was getting out of them when I talked to them.
How's the feedback, after the article came back from them?
Well, most of it has been positive. You know, like I said, they were all excited to see their names in the Washington Post, and they were excited to have this story, you know, shared. You know, it would have been cool if they went ahead and repeated as state champions. They wound up losing in the state championship game. I think the overall it's been pretty positive, the feedback for the story.
Great. Yeah.
Right. What they say, there's no such thing as losing. There's only winning and learning.
Yep.
Yeah, but I mean, there is losing when you get that far, man. I feel bad for this. when you get to the finish line and you right there, and like it came down to the last play, like it was that hurts. That hurts.
Yeah, definitely. Well, much respect to you for writing that. I think it's great that you took the time to do that thorough research for it. And really put that much into it. I want to ask you, switching gears a little bit. I want to ask you about the your take on the Wizards. You know, I was at the game Monday. Had a great event there. You know what I mean? You know, Poetry's Spoken Word event, MLK Day. It was great. But woo, it's tough. But where do the Wizards go from here? What are you seeing? A lot of people have a lot of questions, and it's always so funny that the people come to me to ask me questions. I'm like, I don't know. What do you think? You know what I mean? Like, talk about the fans walking across the, you know, the Concord and everything like that, and everybody, you know, has so many opinions. But where do the Wizards go from here?
They got a hit on the draft. I mean, they're gonna that's gonna be their only objective over the next, you know, 3 years, is to make sure they hit on the draft. I mean, I think they did. They got a nice pick in Bilal. I think he's gonna be a good player. You just hope that the losing, and that there's a culture that doesn't, you know, stain him, you know, and lead him to like take in bad habits. You know, you hope that he can stay positive through these struggles, because you know, DC is not going to attract free agents. It never has. Unfortunately, I don't know why. It doesn't make sense, but it's never been a free agent destination for guys. And you know, the trades have to hit too, but really they're going to have to find stars through the draft. And you know, this upcoming draft is considered weak. There's not any slam dunk prospects, but you always have drafts where you say there's no slam dunk prospects, but there's always at least one guy that comes out of each draft that's wound up being a dominant force. You know, remember the last 2013 draft, it was like, oh, this is a weak draft. And we got Giannis, a two-time MVP, that came out of that draft. Like, so they got to make sure they hit, you know, and that's going to be a challenge. They also got to try to accumulate a lot of as many first round picks as they can so that they can make sure that they can keep, you know, taking swings, you know, at players, at prospects. But there's not a lot of hope. It's not a lot to get excited about. I was expecting them to be a little bit better than they are. I didn't think they'd be good this year, but I didn't think they'd be this bad. And, you know, I worry about, like, how Jordan Poole's handling it. I wish that they traded two of their veterans to get, you know, younger. But I really feel like they need to add a veteran or some veterans in there who kind of understand, you know, what the goal of the team is. Because, like, if you're a young player and you're getting your butt kicked every day and you wonder what the organization is doing, they're just throwing you out there to get slaughtered every night. You figure, well, that's what I'm here to do is lose. But they need somebody in there to kind of talk to them and help them understand that, you know, hey, you know, you're going to get your lumps right now, but know that you're going to get your get back one day. And that's what you got to help these kids understand it. Your get back's coming back, coming down the road, but if you want it. But, you know, and I don't know if that's there yet. So I'm disappointed that they're this bad. And I just feel like their only objective now is just to make sure they get right in the draft, because there aren't a lot of other ways to improve this team.
Yeah, I was telling folks that Jordan Poole was going to be the world be free of 2023. Like, yes, the team won't be good, but he's going to score 28 a game. And so that's been more concerning, frankly, because you feel like mental more than physical. I mean, we know he's got the physical tools. I mean, is it being in Washington and leaving that veteran-laden championship team that he was on, even though they're not so much that this year? I hate playing psychiatrist with people. I don't think.
Yeah, it's, yeah. But I think there's obviously been a lot that he's had to deal with for the last two seasons. You know, starting with the punch. You know, and the public, you know, discourse that's come from that. Everyone talking about, you know, him and in reference to that, and how he can't necessarily separate his career from that moment. And that's got to be a lot on somebody. Like, even when you go somewhere and get a clean slate, and like you make mistakes because now the spotlight's on you because of that, because you played on a championship team, and so now you become a joke. People make fun of you when you have a mistake or you take a bad shot. It becomes, you know, Shaq and a fool like every week, and so then you become a joke. So you go from being a champion to sort of a victim of violence to now you're a joke, and like that toll is going to. It's going to affect you in some ways. And I think that's what's playing out now. It's like, that's why he hasn't been able to break out, because there's a mental block there. And either he hasn't truly overcome that or he hasn't really truly confronted, you know, the situation the way as aggressively as he needs to, you know, for his mental health to get over it. And I'm not sure if the way the team is set up is going to help him do that, because it doesn't like there's a lot of structure out there. Like they're just, I don't know. It's not a fun style of basketball to watch.
You know, it's interesting. You know, of course you look at the main players, and when the team is struggling the way that they are, you know, that, you know, you just kind of know that the main players are going to be the ones, the focus of the criticism. And I've been hearing a lot of criticism directed towards, you know, of course, Poole and Kuzma, you know, heard his name mentioned as possibilities of, you know, different trades and things of that nature. What is your breakdown of what should they do with Kuzma?
I think they should look to move him. I think that, you know, this is a guy that, you know, won a championship with the Lakers, and obviously the Wizards are going to be the team that could pay him better than anybody else. But he has his money now. I think he'd like to be in an environment and in a situation where he can compete and play for something, because he's been in that. He started out with the Lakers, and you know, wound up winning a championship with LeBron and AD. I think he would like to be on that kind of stage again. I think they should try to look to move him in that situation, because all he's doing now is collecting numbers. And the one thing they really need to do, and like I say, the draft's got to be important, but they also got to find guys who want to be in D.C. and want to play in D.C. and, you know, want to kind of build their careers in D.C. That's a starting point, because I think if you got guys that are just there to collect a check or just to play to get their numbers, that's not a good culture to establish. And I think that they have to really focus on, you know, when they do make these deals, you know, they get picks, they get, you know, they or a pick, you know, I don't know what they can get in terms of what the return is for Kyle Kuzma. But I do think that, you know, for the good of, you know, them, they're not competing with him, and I think that he would be more competitive in a different environment. So I think they should try to help find him a place where, because he's got the financial security of his money, but I think he wants to compete, and it ain't happening in D.C.
And let me just follow this up. You know, I've been watching Marvin Bagley III, you know, pretty much since he was in high school, and I was impressed with him. I think he's a young talent. What was your takeaway from that trade?
I mean, the one thing that's been holding him back his whole career is defense. Like he's a bit of a sieve on that end. Like he gives up a lot, and I think that that's one of the issues that's plagued him in Sacramento and then in Detroit. So he's a talented guy. I mean, he can score. Like he's got a lot of skill. But he has to bring it on both ends, and he has to. I think maybe another situation. Maybe Wes can help him. You know, because one thing about Wes, and you saw it with Porzingis last year. You know, a lot of fans get off on Wes and say that, you know, he's not doing what he's supposed to do. But I look at what Porzingis did in his time in D.C. Wes did a lot to make sure that he was in situations where he could thrive and he could succeed, and you saw that he did. Obviously, he had the talent to do it, but you know, the coach did that, and I think Wes is going to try to find ways to make sure that he can thrive on the offensive end, but he has to find a way to incentivize him on the defensive end to be committed on that side, because it's tough to play in this league if you only competing on one end of the floor. Like, he's got to do it on both sides. But I think that, you know, it's probably a good fresh start, because Detroit is somehow worse than the Wizards, but beat them. But I think that having a fresher start here in D.C. Could be good for them, because, frankly, they don't have a lot of size with the Wizards. They don't have a lot of big men, so who can do what he does. So he should get a lot of opportunities to really thrive. In Detroit, it was just a lot. They had too many big men. They had too many centers to really have anybody feel comfortable about their role.
Yeah, I think what I heard from Detroit, you know, knowing a few people there, that it wasn't necessarily a knock on him. They just had a lot of people ahead of him. That's basically what
they did. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's just so many. They had so many bigs. I mean, Wiseman's number two pick, and he's barely seeing the floor over there. And right. You know, maybe now he gets a chance to play too. So, it's tough when you got a lot of young players, a lot of high picks who feel like they have to live up to that status, but they're all competing against each other. So, right. You know, that's the thing about when you have young teams, and that's what the Wizards are going to encounter with all these draft picks they're going to wind up, utilizing over the next couple of years. But hey. It can work out if you do it the right way, because he's coming from, you know, the Clippers. He was in Oklahoma City for a while. You know, you see what the Thunder's doing. You know, they lost KD and Russ, and now, like, look at them. They're right back up there. It's a bit of a grueling process to get back to being relevant, but they're there, you know, because, you know, you gotta take a lot of swings in the draft, and you eventually you're going to hit. And Sam Presti's hitting, so... That's the assignment for the Wizards front office right now. You got to hit.
Yeah, and Josh Giddey got the charges dropped, so a fine. Sorry, people can Google that.
He beat the allegations.
Although the whole world was like, "Gosh, I know it's a young team, but sorry, moving on." Michael, you the piece you wrote is so tremendous. I gotta say. I think people need to read it. It came out in December. It's called Where Tackle Football Still Reigns. It's about Mississippi and football. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Collision.
Hey, thanks for having me, fellas. I appreciate it. And I haven't had a chance to say it, but Happy New Year to you guys, too.
Oh, man. Happy New Year to you, too.
Appreciate it, Mike.
Yeah, that's Mike from The Washington Post. When it comes to writing sports, that's as good as it gets, people. So please.
Nah, this is a lot better than me. I appreciate you, Dave. I'll slide you that 20 as soon as I see you.
The only thing you got to slide is a thank you for telling the truth.
All right.
But, you know, Aton Thomas, it's been a great show, man. Old school, just you and me. Anything, any last things you want to share before we say goodbye?
Let me just say real quick. I'm going to be on a Zoom today, Athlete Speak Out. It's going to be a lot of different athletes talking about what's going on in Palestine. I'll be excited to share next week about how that call went.
Wow, you know, you might have a certain co-radio host on that call too, just so you know. Talking about me. That was a subtle hint. Yo, I just wanted to say for everybody out there listening, you know, be well, be safe, stay frosty. We are out of here. Peace.
It's going to be some stuff you're going to see that's going to make it hard to smile in the future. But through whatever you see, through all the rain and the pain, you got to keep your sense of humor. You got to be able to smile through all this.
Lifestyles be closed captions, addicted to fatal attractions. Pictures of actions be played back in the midst of mashing. No fairy tales for this young black male. Some see me stranded in this land of hell, jail and sales. Hustling and hardly think of culture or the repercussions while busting on backstabbing vultures. Selling my soul for material wishes, fast cars and wishing I live my life a legend, immortalized in pictures. Watch that tears, say your sympathy. My childhood years were spent burying my peers in the cemetery. Here's a message to the newborns waiting to breathe. If you believe, then you can achieve. Just look at me against all odds. Though life is hard, we carry on. Living in the projects, broke with no lights on. To all that sees that follow me, protect your essence. Born with less, but you still precious. Just smile for me now.
Your thoughts slowly upon phrases I run, and I can walk you through the days that are done. I often wish that I could save everyone, but I'm a dreamer. Have you ever seen it? Who was strong in the game? Overlooking his tomorrows, and it finally came. Look back on childhood for a reason I'm still feeling. Turning circles in my ninth grade, dealing too many houses in my local life, survived the strain. And a man without a focus life could drive me insane. Stuck inside a ghetto fantasy, hoping it changed. But when I focus on reality, we broken and chained. Had a dream of living wealthy and making it big. Over football, chose to cook raw and taking it dig. And after all, my mama's thanking God for blessing a child. All my mama got to do now is collecting and smile. Smile.
Smile.
Furious speeds and unanswered questions keep us all stressed and curious. G, backstabbed and bleeding, crooked thoughts laced with learning, ducking straight shots, bullets be hot, they burning, inhaling. Visualize the flames, well I've been smothered by my own pain. Strange whispers, cowards conversate, so quick to distance. Taking pictures for the feds in desperate hopes they get us. Hit us all, give us plenty centuries, forgive my sins. Since I ended many penitentiaries, the best revenge is. We military minded soldiers busting shots.
Sankofa Books, in partnership with WPFW, presents the Black Space Music Series. This Thursday, January 18th, Natalie Greffel and Queen Esther, composers, musicians, and vocalists that stand on the verge of the Black diaspora, delve into their treasure trove of songs and the stories that inspired them. The evening's offerings will move from low country Harlemite Queen Esther's Black Americana to Mozambican Natalie Greffel's Afro-Brazilian dream state, all the while centering Black feminism, creating an oral sanctuary for the audience, and embracing the transcendent web of a Black culture that is the heartbeat of American music. Sankofa Books and Cafe is located at 2714 Georgia Avenue Northwest. Seating is limited, so the event will sell out. Tickets and details at sankofa.com or at 202-234-4755. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
the best in live music entertainment is coming to Bethesda Theater. Peebo Bryson, the legendary voice of love, for two big shows on Friday, January 26th at 8:30 p.m. and Saturday, January 27th at 8 p.m. Celebrate legend Bob Marley at the annual One Love Birthday Bash featuring popular reggae band I&I Rhythm on